Whether this is her first Mother's Day or her 40th, she deserves more. Shop tons of stunning on-trend jewelry for every budget at Diamonds Direct. Diamond fashion jewelry, beautiful birthstones, everyday pearls, starting at just $200. Commemorate the real loves of her life with a gorgeous pendant featuring the birthstone of the one who made her mom. This Mother's Day, Diamonds Direct is everything you need to say thank you. Diamonds Direct, your love, our passion. Online at DiamondsDirect.com.
I'm Tracy from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Are you a small business owner or even someone who dreams of entrepreneurship? Then check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from iHeart Podcasts and Intuit QuickBooks. Join hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres as they interview entrepreneurs sharing insights around starting and nurturing a small business. You won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too.
Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels' family of 22 brands has over 7,400 locations and the perfect hotel for any traveler you want to be. Like a Cambria Hotel, serving up locally inspired craft cocktails for all my folks who maybe want to meet up and talk about Mad Royals. Check into a Radisson Hotel with flexible workspaces for you strivers who listen during business travel. Or a Comfort Hotel with free hot breakfast, family-friendly pools, and big spacious rooms for the parents who listen with their kids and need a little retreat. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you when you book direct at choicehotels.com, where travels come true. Happy Saturday. As we mentioned in our episode on Sarah Bradley Fulton and the Daughters of Liberty, our main source of information on her comes from local historian Helen T. Wild. Wild's other projects included working with the Daughters of the American Revolution to purchase and preserve Royal House, now the museum Royal House and Slave Quarters. Our episode on Belinda Sutton, who was enslaved at Royal House, came out on December 14, 2016, and that is today's Saturday Classic.
In this episode, we mention Isaac Royall Jr.'s bequest to Harvard University and the professorship at Harvard Law that was named for him. The Royal Professorship in Law was retired in 2022.
Also in this episode, we talk about recording some videos for the website How Stuff Works. Our podcast is not affiliated with that website anymore, but you can still see the video on YouTube, and we'll put a link in the description of today's episode.
Only look at the comments on that video if you want to see a lot of people asking, but what about the Irish slaves? Other than that, enjoy.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Tracy B. Wilson.
And I'm Holly Fry.
This October, Holly, you and I had a pretty exciting time on the podcast because you came to visit me.
I did. I brought camera and sound people.
You did. I make it sound like this was like just a trip for funsies. But no, it was a trip to basically go on a video recording extravaganza field trip with two of our How Stuff Works video crew, Casey and Paul. And the four of us spent a lot of time over 3 days interviewing people and recording videos and seeing amazing historical sites. It was both fun and exhausting.
Super exhausting, but super duper fun.
Yeah. I think even more exhausting for Casey and Paul. They did so much of the heavy lifting by nature of being the video and sound people.
Yes, both literally and figuratively. They did a lot of heavy lifting.
Yes, yes. You and I helped carry whenever we could, but, you know, we can't be in front of the camera and also holding it. That doesn't really work with our setup. So the first stop that we made was at the Royal House and Slave Quarters in Medford, Massachusetts. And the Royal House was home to Isaac Royall and his family during the 18th century. And the Royals were the largest slave-owning family in Massachusetts. And they had an enslaved workforce both at their Medford home and on sugar plantations in Antigua, which is a big part of how the Royals made all that money. There is already a video on our website that tells more of the story of the Royals and their enslaved workforce and how those lives intertwine together on the property. And we're going to put a link to it in the show notes and on our social media and all of that kind of stuff when this episode comes out. There are also some more videos already out and coming soon from that trip, which we are really excited about. And we'll also be sharing on our website and social media as those are ready. Today's episode of the podcast is also inspired by our trip to the Royal House Museum. There's a lot that we don't know about the people who were enslaved when it was still a home. And there's documentation for about 60 enslaved people over two generations of royal ownership there on the Massachusetts property. But the actual number was probably quite a lot higher. One enslaved woman in particular stands out, Belinda Sutton, who successfully petitioned for compensation for her years of enslaved labor on the royal property.
And by the time Belinda petitioned for compensation, the royal family was already incredibly wealthy. And just for clarity, I feel like we should point out that when we say the royals again, it's R-O-Y-A-L-L. It's a proper name.
Yes.
Even though you mentioned that his name was Isaac Royal, we just want to make entirely clear.
They were not actual royalty.
And this family was, by this point, incredibly wealthy. But they did not start out incredibly wealthy. Isaac Royal Sr., born 1672, came from a New England family of relatively modest means. But that changed after he purchased a sugar plantation in Antigua.
This was during the era of the triangle trade, that interconnected trading system that relied on enslaved Africans, crops like sugar and cotton, and products made from those crops like rum and cloth. By trading mainly in rum, sugar, and enslaved Africans, Isaac Royal Sr. became very wealthy. It's a common misperception that in North America, only the Southern economy relied on slavery. But in reality, a lot of the wealth in New England and other northerly areas was connected directly to the slave trade and on industries that relied on slave labor.
For a time, the royal family actually lived in Antigua, but in 1737, Isaac Sr. decided to relocate back to New England. And his reasons for doing so were not specifically recorded, but we do know that the year before, a series of gruesome executions had been carried out on Antigua in response to the threat of a slave revolt.
Whether this revolt really was in the works continues to be the subject of some historical debate, and it certainly would not have been the first occurrence of a slave resistance effort on the island if it was. An enslaved man known as Prince Klaas confessed to having planned a massive uprising that would not only have overthrown the island's planters, but also would have massacred its white population.
However, there isn't much physical evidence to support the idea that such a vast uprising was really imminent. So, while some historians are completely convinced that it was, others suspect that the white slave owners and the court, who were vastly outnumbered by the island's enslaved population, exaggerated what was actually a much smaller threat, possibly as a product of their own fear.
The executions, however, were definitely real, with five people being broken on a wheel, six gibbeted, and 77 burned at the stake. One of the royals' enslaved overseers was among those burned at the stake, and another was reprieved at the stake in exchange for information he had. So while it's not written down anywhere exactly what prompted them to go back to New England, it's pretty reasonable to suspect that the royals went back because they feared for their safety.
To prepare for the family's arrival back in Massachusetts, Isaac Royal Sr. bought a piece of property in Medford, which is called Ten Hills Farm. And this was a 500-acre property that housed a colonial farmhouse, which was expanded into a three-story Georgian mansion, along with barns and other outbuildings.
There was also a slave quarters, which still stands today and is the only freestanding slave housing still left in the North. The structure that became the slave quarters started out as an out kitchen or a separate kitchen that would allow people to cook in hot weather without heating up the house. And that was standing before the rest of the quarters were added onto it. The museum on the property today includes both the mansion and the slave quarters.
And when the royals took up residence there at Ten Hills Farm, they had at least 27 enslaved Africans with them.
Isaac Sr. died in 1739, and Isaac Jr., one of his two surviving children, inherited most of the estate. At this point, the royals were one of the wealthiest families in Massachusetts, and Isaac Jr. and his wife Elizabeth were very prominent in society, living a life of absolute luxury and holding lavish parties, and for Isaac's part, also holding public office.
With the approach of the Revolutionary War, Isaac Jr. fled Massachusetts, leaving his mansion, most of his physical property, and more than 20 enslaved people behind. Apparently, he had some sympathies with the cause for independence, but he also had a lot of financial reasons to stay loyal to the crown. He tried to get passage back to Antigua, but he couldn't, and instead he went to Nova Scotia just before the Battle of Lexington in 1775. A year later, he joined his daughter's families in England, and he died there of smallpox in 1781.
In his will, Isaac Jr. left money to Harvard, which was used to endow the university's first law professorship. The shield of Harvard Law School was, for this reason, originally modeled after the royal family coat of arms. The royal professorship still exists, but the law school agreed to retire the shield and replace it with a new one in March of 2016. And as part of the same protests that led to this decision, students actually also occupied a lounge on campus and renamed it Belinda Hall after Belinda Sutton, who we will be talking more about in a moment. Basically, now is the moment that we will be talking more about her.
The moment has arrived. Belinda was mentioned in Isaac Jr.'s will as well, saying, quote, "I do also give unto my said daughter, my Negro woman Belinda, in case she does not choose her freedom. If she does choose her freedom, to have it, provided that she gets security that she shall not be a charge to the town of Medford." And he also instructed his executor to pay Belinda £30 for 3 years.
However, by the time of his death, Isaac Jr. actually no longer had a lot of his property in Massachusetts. A lot of it had been confiscated during the war, and some of the people who had been enslaved there had been freed, and others had been sold elsewhere. In later documents, Belinda, who was referenced in his will, is called Belinda Sutton, a widow, but we don't actually know who her husband was or when she married him. Some of the earliest documents that reference her present her last name as Royal, but it was common for enslaved people to be given their owners' surnames.
Belinda had at least two children, a son named Joseph and a daughter. We're guessing on the pronunciation of whether it's Prine or Priney, but it's P-R-I-N-E, who were baptized in Medford in 1768. And it appears that her son was sold away from her, possibly at the same time that she was freed.
Although the Commonwealth did manumit Belinda, along with at least some of the other people who were confiscated from the royal estate, they didn't really make provisions for her survival afterward. And we will talk about how that led to her petition after a quick word from a sponsor. I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
If you use paper, you're a human. But if you choose paper, you're a papertarian, someone who lives a paper-based lifestyle because it has a positive impact on the planet. And also because it's the easiest choice you'll make all day, seriously. It's as easy as reaching for boxed instead of bottled water. It's as easy as opting for beauty products that come in paper packaging. It's as easy as grabbing eggs in a cardboard container. And that's all in one trip to the grocery store, which, if everyone's being honest, you were planning to go to anyway. But paper isn't just an easy choice. Papertarians know that it's the smart choice, too. Because paper comes from trees, a renewable and sustainably managed resource, and paper products are designed to be recycled. In fact, when you choose products that come in paper-based packaging, those fibers can go on to be recycled up to 7 times. So why wouldn't you go papertarian? Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/papertarian. Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels has a stay for any traveler you want to be with 22 brands and over 7,400 locations. Whether you're a business traveler, a family road tripper, someone who wants to seek out history and maybe make your own, or just planning a quick getaway, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Like a Cambria Hotel, where you can be a cocktail connoisseur and sip locally inspired craft beverages at downtown locations in the center of it all. This is a fun way to visit cities with a lot of history and a lot of fun in mind. Or a Radisson Hotel, for all our productivity powerhouses out there. With flexible workspaces and on-site restaurants, you'll get the most out of your work trip. You'll get the coffee, the Wi-Fi, and the work done. And we can't forget about comfort hotels. Imagine you're a family road tripper, waking up in your big spacious room and then heading down to a free hot breakfast for the entire family, including waffles. So you'll be well-fed and ready for the day's adventure, even if that's just relaxing. After that, you're spending all afternoon relaxing by the pool. You deserve it. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you. Book directly at choicehotels.com, where travels come true.
When Belinda was freed, she and her daughter made their way to Boston to try to start a new life among the free Black people living there. But by this point, Belinda was elderly, and her daughter was also not well. Because she had spent most of her life working for no pay, Belinda had essentially nothing to live on and no way to support herself and her daughter.
On February 14, 1783, Belinda presented a petition to the Massachusetts General Court. It began, quote, "Commonwealth of Massachusetts, to the Honorable the Senate and House of Representatives in General Court assembled. The petition of Belinda, an African, humbly shows that 70 years have rolled away since she on the banks of the Rio de Valta received her existence, the mountains covered with spicy forests, the valleys loaded with the richest fruits spontaneously produced, joined to that happy temperature of air to exclude excess, would have yielded her the most complete felicity had not her mind received early impressions of the cruelty of men whose faces were like the moon and whose bows and arrows were like the thunder and the lightning of the clouds."
The Rio de Valta is what's called the Volta River today, and what was at that point known as the Gold Coast, and it's now Ghana. That was where Belinda had lived until about the age of 12, where, as she described in the petition, she was in a sacred grove with her parents paying devotions to Oricha, and, quote, "an armed band of white men driving many of her countrymen in chains ran into the hallowed shade.
Referring to herself in the third person, she goes on, quote, "she was ravished from the bosom of her country, from the arms of her friends, while the advanced age of her parents, rendering them unfit for servitude, cruelly separated her from them forever."
After she describes her passage across the Atlantic and her arrival on a new continent, she states that she worked for 50 years for Isaac Royall until after the war before concluding, quote, "the face of your petitioner is now marked with the furrows of time, and her frame feebly bending under the oppression of years, while she, by laws of the land, is denied the enjoyment of one morsel of that immense wealth, a part whereof has been accumulated by her own industry, and the whole augmented by her servitude. Wherefore, casting herself at the feet of your honors, as to a body of men formed for the extirpation of vassalage, for the reward of virtue, and the just return of honest industry, she prays that such allowance may be made her out of the estate of Colonel Royall, as will prevent her and her more infirm daughter from misery in the greatest extreme, and scatter comfort over the short and downward path of their lives, and she will ever pray."
So, in five paragraphs, Belinda describes her childhood in Ghana, her capture, the Middle Passage, her arrival, and the fact that she spent most of her life helping to build the wealth of the royal family, when she herself was not allowed any portion of that wealth or even to own any property. And she ends by asking for reparations, a payment of damages for having been wronged, specifically to be taken out of the estate of the man she worked for without being compensated for all that time.
Some of the petition's passages aren't necessarily meant to be read completely literally. For example, the word Oricha is Yoruba, and it's a word that means deity. But Yoruba was spoken a little farther west than the Gold Coast where Belinda would have been from. So it's not entirely clear where Belinda or perhaps the person who helped her write this petition might have learned it or how they might have used it.
The description of Belinda's capture also specifies that her captors were white. However, it's far more likely that she was initially captured by other Africans further inland before being taken to the coast and sold to white slave traders. You can learn more about this aspect of the slave trade in our past podcasts on Dahomey and the Royal Palaces of Abomey. Describing her abductors as white may have been an intentional effort to appeal to the moral sensibilities of the white judges, or to resist attempts to shift the blame for slavery onto Africans who captured the slaves, rather than on the Europeans who created the demand for them.
You will still see people trying to make this argument on the internet today. Most likely, Belinda herself was illiterate. Her signature on this and other petitions is an X. And her most likely assistant in creating this petition was a man named Prince Hall. He had been enslaved from birth around 1735, and then he had been freed in 1770. After becoming freed, he became an activist and an abolitionist in Boston, where he was also the founder of an African Masonic lodge. He helped author at least two petitions for a general manumission in Massachusetts. And we will talk a little bit more about these other petitions that were also presented during Belinda's life and around the same time a little bit later in the show.
Belinda's petition also quickly became part of a growing body of anti-slavery literature. Quaker abolitionists distributed copies, and the New Jersey Gazette reprinted it in its entirety on June 18th of 1783. Soon, this petition was being reprinted in other newspapers and anti-slavery journals on both sides of the Atlantic. In at least one British case, there were quite a number of creative liberties, basically rewriting this legal petition into a slave narrative in the first person.
In terms of the ruling, Belinda's petition was successful. In 1783, the court awarded her and her daughter an annual pension of £15.12 to be paid out of the profits of the royal estate. However, the estate only paid this pension for a year and then ignored Belinda's repeated requests for it.
In 1787, Belinda went back to court to try to force the royal estate to pay the pension as ordered, and the court once again found in her favor. The estate did make its payments for 3 years before stopping again, leading Belinda back to court in 1790. And after payments stopped once again, she had to submit yet another petition in 1793, and once again the ruling was in her favor.
From there, there's really no record of her until Willis Hall, who had been the executor of Isaac Royal Jr.'s estate, requested that he be granted the rest of the money in the state treasury, saying, quote, two family servants who were left behind, end quote, had then died. Presumably, one of the people he is talking about was Belinda, and that was in 1799.
And Belinda's petition was by far not the first nor the only petition connected to slavery to be presented in Massachusetts courts, as we mentioned just a moment ago. And we're going to talk more about this topic after we first pause for a word from one of our fantastic sponsors.
I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
If you use paper, you're a human. But if you choose paper, You're a papertarian, someone who lives a paper-based lifestyle because it has a positive impact on the planet. And also because it's the easiest choice you'll make all day, seriously. It's as easy as reaching for boxed instead of bottled water. It's as easy as opting for beauty products that come in paper packaging. It's as easy as grabbing eggs in a cardboard container. And that's all in one trip to the grocery store, which, if everyone's being honest, you were planning to go to anyway. But paper isn't just an easy choice. Papertarians know that it's the smart choice, too. Because paper comes from trees, a renewable and sustainably managed resource, and paper products are designed to be recycled. In fact, when you choose products that come in paper-based packaging, those fibers can go on to be recycled up to 7 times. So why wouldn't you go Papertarian? Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/papertarian. Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels has a stay for any traveler you want to be, with 22 brands and over 7,400 locations. Whether you're a business traveler, a family road tripper, someone who wants to seek out history and maybe make your own, or just planning a quick getaway, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Like a Cambria Hotel, where you can be a cocktail connoisseur and sip locally inspired craft beverages at downtown locations in the center of it all. This is a fun way to visit cities with a lot of history and a lot of fun in mind. Or a Radisson Hotel, for all our productivity powerhouses out there. With flexible workspaces and on-site restaurants, you'll get the most out of your work trip. You'll get the coffee, the Wi-Fi, and the work done. And we can't forget about comfort hotels. Imagine you're a family road tripper, waking up in your big spacious room and then heading down to a free hot breakfast for the entire family, including waffles. So you'll be well-fed and ready for the day's adventure, even if that's just relaxing. After that, you're spending all afternoon relaxing by the pool. You deserve it. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you. Book directly at choicehotels.com, where travels come true.
Belinda's petition was part of ongoing legal efforts of enslaved and formerly enslaved people to advocate for themselves through Massachusetts courts. A lot of these were petitions for freedom. There were enough of those that there are definitely sources that misreport Belinda's petition as being one for her freedom, which it was not. The Anti-Slavery Petitions Massachusetts Dataverse at Harvard has a huge collection of anti-slavery and anti-segregation documents, including Belinda's petitions, online.
As early as 1770, individual enslaved people in Massachusetts were suing their owners in court for their own freedom, or for compensation for their labor, or for both. And some of these suits were, in fact, successful.
Petitions for general freedom for all people enslaved in Massachusetts started before the Revolutionary War as well. Enslaved people submitted 6 different petitions for general emancipation between 1773 and 1777 alone. Prince Hall, who probably helped Belinda craft her petition, had submitted 2 of these in the late 1770s, asking for a general emancipation, protection against being kidnapped back into slavery, financial help for former slaves who wanted to settle in Africa, and public education access for Black students.
Many of these early petitions were connected directly to the language the Patriot cause was using to frame the Revolutionary War and the wish for the colonies to be freed from British rule. They called on the courts to recognize that the inalienable right to freedom was not limited only to white people. These 1770s petitions prompted one bill to abolish slavery in Massachusetts, although it was ultimately unsuccessful.
Some of the petitions also drew from the Bible, citing Old Testament passages requiring the freeing of slaves every 7 years, with those freed slaves being compensated. In one case, petitioners submitted a pamphlet by James Swan, who was a member of the Sons of Liberty and a participant in the Boston Tea Party, which attacked slavery from numerous angles, including the biblical one.
It's possible that Belinda's petition was patterned after or inspired by the petition of Anthony Vassall of Cambridge, Massachusetts. He had submitted a petition in 1781 requesting the title to land owned by his former owner, John Vassall, as compensation for his years of unpaid labor. Before being enslaved under John Vassall, Anthony and his wife had lived in Medford, where they had been owned by Isaac Royal Jr.'s sister, Penelope Vassall.
John Vassal was a loyalist who had been exiled and whose estate had been confiscated. And Anthony successfully argued that he was owed reparations for having worked on that land where his wife and their children had also been enslaved. Although he wasn't awarded the title to the land that he asked for, he was granted an annual pension of £12 out of the proceeds of the estate.
It was, in fact, court rulings that would eventually end slavery in Massachusetts. In 1781, Elizabeth Freeman, then known as Mum Bett, successfully sued her owner for freedom under the grounds that the newly adopted Massachusetts Constitution forbade it in Article 1, quote, "All men are born free and equal and have certain natural, essential, and unalienable rights, among which may be reckoned the right of enjoying and defending their lives and liberties, that of acquiring, possessing, and protecting property, in fine, that of seeking and obtaining their safety and happiness."
That same year, an enslaved man known as Quack Walker escaped from Nathaniel Jennison. And when Jennison found Walker, he beat him, leading Walker to sue him for assault and battery. This led to a series of countersuits ending with Commonwealth versus Jennison in 1783. During the instructions to the jury, Chief Justice Cushing stated, quote, "And upon this ground, our constitution of government, by which the people of the this commonwealth have solemnly bound themselves, sets out with declaring that all men are born free and equal, and that every subject is entitled to liberty and to have it guarded by the laws, as well as life and property, and in short, is totally repugnant to the idea of being born slaves. This being the case, I think the idea of slavery is inconsistent with our own conduct and constitution. There can be no such thing as perpetual servitude of a rational creature unless his liberty is forfeited by some criminal conduct or given up by personal consent or contract."
Commonwealth versus Jennison effectively ended slavery in Massachusetts, although there continued to be some people enslaved for some time afterward, particularly under the guise of indentured servitude.
So that is Belinda's petition. There are a lot of people and articles that describe Belinda's first petition as the first petition for reparations for slavery to exist in the United States. I think that's a little oversimplified, not to fault anybody in that a lot of these petitions were really difficult to access until that big Harvard database that we talked about a little bit earlier was online, and it became a lot easier to search through them. It made those documents a lot more accessible to people. But Belinda's petition definitely is part of a much greater legal effort that was ongoing in Massachusetts for years to try to, at least on an individual basis, compensate some previously enslaved people for basically the damage that was done to them by having them be part of building their owner's wealth while forbidden to you know, accumulate any wealth or possessions of their own. Thanks so much for joining us on this Saturday. Since this episode is out of the archive, if you heard an email address or a Facebook URL or something similar over the course of the show, that could be obsolete now. Our current email address is historypodcast@iheartradio.com. You can find us all over social media at Missed in History. And you can subscribe to our show on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, the iHeartRadio app, and wherever else you listen to podcasts. Stuff You Missed in History Class is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elia Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.